Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. Last week, I conducted a funeral service for the first time. The person who died was a lady called Pauline, who was a regular here at Dharmaloka on Friday nights. And for the last year of her life, she would bring Dana up to the nuns' monastery every Saturday. And Saturday shifts, as you might imagine, after a late Friday night, are the unpopular shift of the week. But she didn't miss a Saturday. And even when she was very sick and she couldn't prepare food because she was nauseous at the smell of food, she still went out and bought food to bring to make sure that we at least could eat something that day. Pauline asked me if I would be with her while she was dying and if I would conduct her funeral service. And so that's how I came to do that. And the way that she prepared for her death was so inspiring and so much the result of her years of practice that I would like to share with you how she prepared for dying and for death. I'm sure she would be pleased if anything that she experienced could be of use to fellow practitioners. And also I have discussed the fact that I'm going to give this talk with her family, and they're also very happy to share any of the experience so that other people can benefit from how she went through this very significant experience, to say the least. It's very inspiring the way in which Pauline approached her death, because like many of us born in a Western culture, a non-Buddhist culture, she came to Buddhism late in life. And very often we think as Westerners that we can't really go the whole way with this practice because we haven't had the good fortune to start young enough. We've got too much old conditioning behind us. And the fact that she was able to live out her practice to the very breath is an encouragement for all of us that we can do that ourselves. Coming from a non-Buddhist background, her family situation wasn't one where talk about death was the usual topic. In Buddhist households, at least in theory, people are aware of the fact that death is a certainty and that one day we're all going to die. And in Buddhist societies, usually even if someone doesn't die at home, the body is brought home. So there's much more familiarity with death and dying. And the other thing about Pauline was that although she was a Buddhist, none of her family members are. And so they didn't have the same framework that she was operating within. And yet, even with these obstacles, you might say, she was still able to arrange things in the way that she knew would be most supportive for her practice and for her further journey in samsara. Because one of the very significant factors that she was operating with was she believed that this wouldn't be just the end of this life, but it would be the start of a new birth. This is straightforward Buddhist teaching. But how many of us really believe that? And how many of us approach our death with that understanding? It's not just a matter of dying well, or dying as painlessly as possible, or as quickly as possible. It's a matter of how are we going to produce good conditions for the next life. This is a very impressive thing about the way Pauline approached her death. This was uppermost in her mind. And she knew that the way she died and the way she set up her death was going to be important because of how it would affect the possibility of a favourable rebirth. This is wonderful Buddhist practice. And so she was able to prepare for her death with this in mind. Now, Pauline had had a number of bouts of cancer over the last 20 years, and each time she had cancer, she did what was necessary to try to get well. She took the treatments, took the medication, even when it made her very sick, even when it was difficult. And this is in line with Buddhist practice also. We don't know where we're going to be reborn after this life is over. And if we reflect on how good the conditions are for our practice and the development of wisdom right now, then it only makes sense that we do all we can to keep this life going for as long as possible. We have the teachers, we have the teaching, we have good friends, we have places like this where we can come together, we have meditation retreats, we have all sorts of very supportive conditions for the development of wisdom in this life. And we don't know in our next birth whether we're going to have those same conditions. And so it makes sense, it's good practice to do what we can to stay alive as long as possible. And that's what she'd done. But during the course of her latest illness, it became clear that there was a strong possibility that this time she wasn't going to get well. And she started to face that possibility and to accept that she was likely to die. And so she started to make preparations to try to die well. Not because she no longer loved life, not because she didn't want to live anymore, but because she accepted death. It's a big difference. Because she'd had a lot of illness over many years, she was very aware of the unreliability of this body. That even when you think that it's healthy, even when you haven't got a diagnosed illness, there can be all sorts of things going wrong inside, from the minor to the major. It doesn't show on the surface. And it's interesting that people who didn't know that Pauline was sick, when they've heard that she's died, they say, "Oh, she didn't look sick. She looked so well last time I saw her." This is the great deception that we all suffer under. All of us could be having something inside us that's not working well at the moment or that's breaking down. And on the surface, it looks fine. Who can tell? This body is like that. And she'd learned that it was very unpredictable. And because of its unpredictability, she put lots of effort into cultivating the mind, developing her meditation practice. And she also had put a lot of effort into learning to live until she died. She didn't settle back and say, oh, well, now I'm going to die. I might as well just sit back and wait till it happens. Ah, miserable. No. She had learned to appreciate every day that she had. She wasn't a miserable person to be around. She learned to take joy in small things. In the parts of her body that did work, she appreciated them. She learned to take joy in her family and her friends, because although her family and friends weren't Buddhist, they were very loving and caring, a very close-knit family and set of friendships that she also placed great value and store in and put a lot of effort into maintaining. So at her funeral, her grandchildren got up and said how she used to spend one day a week with them, helping them with their schoolwork. And her granddaughter said, I always got A's with my projects because Grandma always helped me with them. And so she continued to do all of those things. And she also enjoyed just the fact that she had another day. And whatever was to be enjoyed in that day, she made much of. So she maintained a very bright state of mind. The other thing that she did, knowing that her time might be running out, was to finish off whatever unfinished business there was, particularly in her relationships with her family and friends. She did a lot of work on forgiveness. Sometimes she had to forgive others, and sometimes she had to get forgiveness from the people that she'd been in close contact with in this life. And all of us have a mixture of relationships with people, light and dark, up and down. And so when we know that we don't have much longer to live, it's a very skillful thing to try to tidy up any of those relationships. Even if we can't speak to the person again, even if we can't contact them or do anything to repair a damaged relationship in an obvious way, at least we have to come to peace with that in our own heart. Sometimes we need to talk about it to someone else. Sometimes we need to do something say we're sorry. Whatever it is, this is the time when we have to really do some difficult work. And that's what Pauline did. So she was very at ease with the relationships in her life. And then she had to talk to her family and friends about the fact that she wanted to die in a particular way. Part of healing relationships and giving forgiveness was also to say goodbye. And there's very often this tendency to think, well, I won't say goodbye too soon because it might make the end come even quicker. I'll put it off for as long as I can. And particularly if we know that we're not well, or we know someone else isn't well, that can be very foolish. Because, first of all, we don't know how long the person has, and particularly if someone is at the end of a long series of treatments, very often the body has complications. All sorts of things can happen which are unexpected. If they're in hospital, they can get infections, they can have a fall, they can have all sorts of things happen, which means that though we thought they had weeks, they only have a week. And their physical condition can very often make it difficult for them to have the energy to give to the people who want to come around and say their goodbyes. And also, if they're in a lot of pain, the medication that they need to take in order to help them with their pain can also make it very difficult for them to concentrate or to pay full attention to whoever comes to see them, particularly if it's towards the end of their life. And so it again makes sense when we're in this situation or when we're in a relationship with someone who's coming towards the end of their life, not to wait too long to say our farewells, to tell them how much we love them, and to finish off any unfinished business that we might have with them. Because there comes a time in the person's journey that they are focusing more and more on what they need. And they don't have so much mental energy for the people who are going to be here after they're gone. Very often people are going and saying, I don't want you to die. I don't want you to go. How am I going to survive without you? And that is very unfair, because this person has to do their journey. Each one of us is on our own individual journey. And the person who's dying has got enough to deal with without having to cope with other people's unresolved feelings. So one of the things that helped Pauline's family to come to terms with the fact that it looked like she was going to die was her own acceptance of her death and the clarity with which she was able to explain to them how she wanted to die and why. What she came up with in the end was, who will support me on this next phase of my journey? Who will help me not only to die well, but also to have the best possibility of a favourable rebirth? And so she decided, out of all the people who wanted to be with her when she was dying, that she would like to have her daughter and myself. And she was able to do the work in the weeks before her death to gently but clearly let people know why she was doing this and how important it was to her. It was hard. There were people there who wanted to be with her right to the end because they couldn't bear the thought of losing her. And yet, because of her strength of mind and her clarity, and because of their love for her, they were willing to give her what she wanted. This is a very important thing. It was very impressive, remembering that none of these people are Buddhists or have any exposure to the Buddha's teaching, really. They loved Pauline enough to put her first and to give her what she wanted. As we come closer towards our death, we're very often dependent on the people around us in a way we never expected to be, particularly if we consider ourselves to be independent people. I do my own thing. I don't like other people to fuss over me. I don't like to have to rely on others. This is one of the big lessons that we often encounter in a very hard way when we get sick. And this is one of the realities And not only are we dependent for our physical well-being, but because other people are often the ones who are providing us with the place to be, providing our environment. And so if we have particular needs, particular desires of how that situation should be, we need to be clear about it while we still have the mental and physical strength to make it clear and to make it happen. And that's what Pauline did. When she was in hospital for the last time, she was in quite a lot of pain. And she called me, or I called her on the telephone and spoke to her, and she said to me, because of the medication, "Sister, what are those five things that we take?" That was the precepts and the three refuges. And her mind was so confused because of the medication that she couldn't quite bring them to mind, even though she'd heard them many, many times. This is the sort of confusion we can get into. So when we went to visit her in hospital, I gave her the refuges and precepts, and Anagarika Elizabeth, who was with me, repeated them after me. And as soon as Pauline heard Namo Tassa, she said, "Ah, that's it." And she started, and she also chanted Namo Tassa and took the refuges and precepts. And then we did a little meditation together, and because she had the guidance and the support, she was able to focus her mind again and come back to her practice. This is a very important thing for us to reflect on, because when we are under medication or getting weak because of the illness, the mind doesn't have its normal strength. Very often there's not the normal clarity. And so we need to have something very simple that we can focus on and take hold of in our consciousness. Traditionally, in Buddhist countries, it's a practice to have people write down all the good things they've done in their life, so that when they're lying in their bed sick or near death, someone can sit there and remind them, read out what they've done. But we may not have a book full of things that we've done. Or our mind might be too weak and confused to really take it in. So what we need is something simple, something straightforward that really connects us to the goodness of our life, that brings up the joy that goes with that connection and that memory. And so something as simple as Namo Tassa, homage to the Buddha. If we repeat it every day, if it becomes just second nature to us, then that's the kind of thing that we can call up when we really need it. It doesn't have to be a complicated thing. It's just the connection with the goodness of our life. And that's what Pauline was able to do, even with a mind that was very confused. Now, she left hospital and she went home to die. The last week or so, she'd been back and forth to hospital, and now she was wanting to come home. And we went to see her and set out a plan of how regularly we would come to see her. And then this is a typical scenario. It didn't work out that way. She got sick sooner than anyone had expected. And so a couple of days later, before I was due to come and see her, I got a phone call from her daughter to say, "Mum's not doing too well, can you come?" And I spoke to Pauline on the phone, and she said, "Sister, what do I do now?" And I said, "Pauline, just stay with the present moment. Don't fear what is coming next. Just stay with what is happening right now." She was vomiting blood. She was in pain. But she could bear with that. It was the thought of what might be next that was worrying her. So as we talked, I said, just stay with what's happening now. This breath, feelings in the body. And she said, right, that's what I'll do. Now, she couldn't say, right, that's what I'll do, if she hadn't practiced being in the present moment, being with the pleasant and the unpleasant in this life, with acceptance, with equanimity. During the meditation this evening, I was suggesting, do this to bring the attention into the present moment. Stay with the breath in the present moment. This is the kind of practice which builds up the ability of the mind to stay in the present moment. And as we practice meditation and develop inner peace, we develop the ability to stay in the present moment even if it's not pleasant. And Pauline was able to do that because that's what she had cultivated for many years. So when we arrived at Pauline's house, the nurse was there, the doctor was on his way because she was uncomfortable. She was in pain. She was very happy to see us. And the first thing that I did after greeting her was to give her refuge and precepts, to remind her again of the goodness of her life. And then we did some more chanting and she quietened down. It was very interesting to see that although she was in the middle of a very intense experience, she was able to focus and stay with what was happening, not allowing the mind to run off into the future. And over the course of time that we'd been discussing her death and how she was dealing with it day by day, she told me that sometimes she was really excited. This is something she'd never done before, that she could remember anyway. She was really excited about dying. It was an anticipation, was sort of the last great mystery. But other times, she was fearful. What's it really going to be like? What's going to happen? So throughout the course of her illness, there was this mixture of excitement, wonder, and also hope and fear. And yet she managed to deal with all of those emotions and to keep them under control, if you like, until at this time she was able to just focus in the present moment with what was happening. And the family were extremely supportive. The last members of the family, the ones very close, came and said goodbye. And then we were left with just the daughter, myself, and Anagarika Elizabeth in the room. And her daughter, respecting her mother's wishes with great strength, didn't allow other people to come back into the room, but gave Pauline the peace and quiet that she wanted. Her daughter was outstanding because what she gave her mother at this time was tremendous love. It wasn't as though she was standing back and not doing anything to express care and concern for her mother. She was sitting with her mother on the bed, lying next to her, holding her hand, touching her gently, telling her that she loved her. And what a great mother she'd been. Best mother in the world, she said, with great tenderness, but not with the idea, I can't be without you, don't go. There was no grasping in the love that she was giving. And this is incredible. Can you imagine being able to give in that moment, the sort of love that is strong, pure, and not grasping. Tremendous, tremendous support. And so that's what was happening. She was giving the loving care, and I was there doing some chanting and giving some support with the Dharma. And Pauline turned to me and she said, "I'm ready to go, sister. I'm really ready to go." I said, "Good, Pauline." I said, "Is there anything that you're worried about? Is there anything that you still haven't finished?" And she said, no, I'm not worried." I said, "Are there any unwholesome thoughts that you have that you want to finish with?" And she said, with great honesty, "I don't have those kinds of thoughts anymore." Just like a child saying with great honesty, that was not a worry for her. And when I gave her the refuge and precepts, she wasn't able to take them, but when she finished, when I finished chanting them, I brought her hands together in the Anjali mudra, which is how we take the precepts, and I said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." And a smile came on her face like a young child who'd been given a Christmas present that she didn't expect. She was so happy to hear those words again. But now she was ready to go, and she wanted to finish it. She said, I'm ready now. I want it to finish." And I said, "Well, Pauline, you can't, because this is the lesson that we've been learning right through our practice. This body doesn't belong to me. It's not operating according to our wishes and our desires for it. Don't you remember Achan Brahm's simile of the driverless bus? We're all on this driverless bus. We think we're in control, but we're actually just a passenger on the bus. And you have to sit back and wait till this bus gets to your stop." And she said, "You mean I can't die now?" And I said, "No, you have to wait." And she said, "Bugger." And then she said, "Ah, I'm not pulling the strings, not the driverless bus." I said, "Yes, that's right. So if you can just lie back, be in the present moment." And that's what she did. She surrendered to the present moment. She lay back and she just went with what was happening without anticipating. And it took her several hours from that time to die. But she, as I say, surrendered to the whole process, to the experience. And throughout the time that she was dying, we were chanting and wishing her well. And as she became weaker and weaker, you could see that she was withdrawing further and further into herself. And sometimes I would stop chanting and she would make a noise to indicate that she knew I had stopped chanting, and so then we'd have to start up again. And to remind her, "We're still here, Pauline." And at times it was hard going. It's actually hard work to die. It's not simple and straightforward. We wish, we hope, that we could just lie on the bed and say, "Okay, I'm ready to go," and the light goes out. It doesn't happen like that. And Pauline experienced that, discovered it, but surrendered to it. And so over the next few hours, she got weaker, withdrew further into herself. And then when it was clear to me that she was coming very close to the end of her life, I chanted the refuges and precepts once more. And at the end of them, I said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu, and Pauline took her last breath. And this is a true story. It was an incredible experience. Just before she died, she said her daughter's name several times. She knew her daughter was there, and she knew that I was there. And even though it wasn't obvious that she could hear what was going on, she was aware. She was aware of the energy, and she was aware of the love, and she was aware of the support that she was getting, and she was focusing on that. It was an incredible death, but it didn't happen just because I was there to chant for her. People have said to me, "Oh, well, sister, she had the good karma to have you there." But that was just one condition. Just imagine if someone on the street was dying and I went up to them and gave them refuge and precepts, or chanted Namo Tassa, or life is impermanent. What do you think they'd do as they were dying? Do you think they'd think it was wonderful and be appreciated? Or just ask yourself, when you're dying, what would it mean to you if you heard refuge and precepts? What would you like to hear as the last thing in this life? Maybe you'd like to hear someone saying, "Don't go." I'm telling you all this and in such detail because all of us are going to face this moment, not only the end of this life, but the beginning of the next life. How do we want to do it? What preparation are we making in order to do it well? None of us knows when that's going to be. We may not have a few years to get ready, a few months or a few weeks. We might still be hoping that it's going to happen later, and it happens now. How ready are we? Pauline's death, the way that it happened and the way that she met it, didn't happen by accident. Didn't happen just because I was there. It happened because of all the work that she's done over many years. She attended the last retreat at Safety Bay in November, even though she was ill. She kept on coming to Dharmaloka to hear the Dharma talk and to be with her Dharma friends. She kept on offering dana and doing all that she could, right up until the time when she was incapable of that kind of work. She kept on living her life right up until the time that she died. And even though people didn't know what it meant to be a Buddhist until Pauline died, many people in her circle of friends and her family certainly learned that lesson because of the way that she not only lived, but the way that she died. I wonder if we will be such good examples of our practice when we die. So I offer these reflections for all of us. May this teaching be of benefit on the path of practice, and particularly tonight I dedicate the merits of this teaching to Pauline, wishing that her further journey in samsara will be accompanied by Dharma friends, Dharma teachings, and the possibility to practice for the end of all suffering. May this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer, or comments. Yes. question is, what is a Buddhist funeral? Well, I made mine up as I went along. It was the first funeral that I'd done, and it wasn't strictly according to tradition. It's an interesting thing because nuns in Sri Lanka, where I was trained, they didn't do funerals there either. In fact, even if it was one of our supporters who had died, we used to go and do some chanting, and then we had to leave before the monks got there because they were the ones who did all the formal ceremonies. So I never got trained in how to conduct a proper Buddhist funeral. And even here in Perth, I've never been to any of the funerals that the monks conduct. So I got some pointers from Achanyana, and basically what happens in the funeral, and this it would be generally, is that there is a reflection on the impermanence of life, I suppose, and the person who's died, if the Sangha member knows who that person is. If it's a traditional Buddhist funeral, some chanting of verses relevant to the teaching on impermanence and the fact that death is certain. Achan Brahm always throws in a few jokes, even at a funeral, tells a few stories. There's usually an opportunity for the people who are present to ask forgiveness of from the person who's died for anything that they've done by body, speech or mind, intentionally or unintentionally, that's caused that person harm, and also to give forgiveness to that person if there's any unfinished business that they may have. And in the service that I conducted, because the people weren't Buddhist, I had a very nice shrine set up, and I just explained to the people that the Buddha was a representation of the enlightened mind, the compassionate heart, and that the candles represent the light of wisdom, and the incense the fragrance of a life well lived, and the flowers were something beautiful that we offer to that which we take as the highest, the thing that we aspire to be like. And I pointed out that this was what Pauline aspired to be like the Buddha, with that wise and loving heart. So that's how I tried to connect her aspiration and her Buddhist practice to the way she'd lived her life. And then after I'd said a few words about Pauline and how well she'd lived and died, then I invited people to come up and talk about Pauline, who knew her. And that was a very beautiful part of the service because her grandchildren got up and spoke, and she had friends who were young children in their 11 and 12 year olds got up and told funny stories about her, and young men in their 20s got up and said what a good friend she was, and it was a wonderful all ages and got up and said things. And then after that we had the opportunity for people to ask and give forgiveness, and during that time I chanted the Buddha's words on loving kindness, and there were a number of Pauline's Buddhist friends there, so they also chanted along with me. And then after that we invited people to come up and put flowers on the coffin as a way of saying farewell and also paying tribute to Pauline. Now, this was a very nice thing about Pauline. She didn't want any fuss and she didn't want people to spend money. So the coffin was a plywood coffin, and it had been painted and decorated by her family, and it was painted in the colours that she chose, and it looked very beautiful. And she had not wanted people to spend money on flowers. She said if people have flowers from their garden, then they're welcome to bring them. And so people had all sorts of different arrangements that they'd brought from their garden. And there were lots of children there, and all ages and all ethnic backgrounds. And they all came forward and put a flower on the coffin. Or if they didn't have flowers, they lit a stick of incense and put by her. And basically that was the end. And then we played some music that she likes and give peace a chance. And what was the other one? Give peace a chance. Oh, yes, imagine. That's right. Because imagine and give peace a chance while people were coming forward and putting the flowers on the coffin. And that was the end. It was very, very beautiful. It wasn't held at a crematorium, it was held at a funeral parlour. So there was plenty of time for us to do what we wanted to do. And people said that they felt joyful afterwards. Even though they were sad that Pauline had gone, they felt joyful. And that was what we were hoping for. So that's basically what a Buddhist funeral would be like. Pauline was from New Zealand, and one of her Maori friends got up and also did a beautiful chant for her in the Maori language, which was very lovely. The question is, how does the person's state of mind at the time of death affect one's rebirth? And the way that we understand the interconnection between body and mind is that this body is like the vehicle, if you like. It's like a set of clothes that we put on at the beginning of this birth. And the kind of clothes we have that we get depends on the way we've lived our life in the previous birth. And throughout this life, we have the opportunity to develop wholesome states of mind and to also, if we don't know it or don't watch out, develop unwholesome states of mind. And so our job during this life is to try to make the unwholesome states grow and the wholesome states grow, not the unwholesome. Make the wholesome states grow and the unwholesome states subside. So that at the point of death, we have a mind which is filled with some kind of goodness. If you experience what your mind is like while you're alive, you'll know that it is constantly changing. It is changing moment by moment by moment. And there's constant interaction between the mind and the body. If you're angry, then it affects the body. If you're feeling happy, the body feels a different way. You can see very clearly the connection between mind states and the state of the body. And also that the mind is constantly arising and passing away moment by moment by moment. And the other example is that when we go to bed at night, we go to sleep, where do we go? We don't know what's happening, but when we wake up in the morning, there's continuity between what happened yesterday and what we feel the next morning. Even though we're not aware of what happened to the mind between going to sleep and waking up. We may have had dreams, but we can't even remember them very often. So the journey between this life and the next life is similar. From one mind moment to the next, the last mind moment in this life, there is continuity into the next life. And that will be affected by the state of mind at the end of this birth. Just as in the same way that if we go to bed and we're very angry, we often have a restless sleep and we wake up continuing the argument that we had just before we fell asleep. If we go to sleep feeling very happy, then we wake up in the morning feeling bright, feeling energized. It's the same sort of connection from one life to the next. So that's why it's so important what we have in our mind at the time that we die. And the the last sense that goes is the sense of hearing. So even when someone seems to be unconscious or not in contact, very often they can still hear. And you'll notice people who are in a coma or who are even on life support systems, that if you make sounds in the room or if you talk about someone that they have a strong connection with, very often they'll make some sort of movement to indicate that they know what's going on. And that's why it's very important not to speak loudly or to speak about unnecessary things around someone who's dying. You need to give them all the space that they require in order to be at peace. Another question which often comes up is the idea that being Buddhists, we shouldn't have any pain relief at the time of illness or death, that we want to keep our mind clear so that we can face our death with our eyes open, if you like. But my experience is that if people have severe pain, then their mind is already clouded by trying to cope with that pain. And so it's very often counterproductive to try to just see it through without any pain relief. And if you are aware of this, then it's often very good to start getting used to or finding out which kind of pain relief suits you best so that you can work with it and use it well up until the time that you die. And also, even when someone seems to be not really fully with you, that person is still aware of what's going on, even if they can't communicate. And particularly if you have prepared the mind and trained the mind to keep coming back, keep coming back. This is why we sit in meditation and try to keep coming back to the meditation object. This is the training of the mind. Does that answer your question? Question is, at the time of death, when that's that opportunity, is that when the merit that we've gained in this life comes together and helps us? The merit that we've made is constantly fruiting in this life, providing us with all sorts of conditions for our continued well-being and happiness. And it's also present at that time of approaching death. But we never know what other things we've accumulated that are also going to play themselves out at that time when the mind energy gets weaker and weaker. And so it's obviously very important that we accumulate as much merit as possible and have it there as our support at that time. And particularly to understand the fact that the mind is constantly changing. Even when we're well, even when we're strong, this mind runs riot very often. And so we can't expect that at the time of our death, unless we practice strongly, that merit is going to be sufficient to keep the mind on one track. So we have to, the merit includes the good that we've done, but it also has to include the meditation practice, the deliberate training of the mind. That's the merit that's really going to stand us in good stead.